content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Rookie Magazine and Teen Vogue. Our first article for today's program is from Rookie Magazine, and in the spirit of graduation season, this article is titled, It's Your Party. Celebrate graduation however you like. This article was written by Victoria Chu and was published May 11th of 2016. Pop culture contains a million and one examples of the mundanity and horrors of high school, and there are just as many that build up the perfection of prom night. After years of seemingly endless homework, piles of projects, and mind-wringing exams, and the compound stress and anxiety, I really did start to subscribe to the idea that prom was a reward for enduring the academic trials of the years before. According to the sentimental recollections of alumni and teachers, at its best, prom was the incredible gathering of formerly divided classmates. Together, we'd acknowledge the end of high school and all its irritations and look toward the future. The way they talked about it, graduation and prom were transcendent, life-changing experiences, and their ardor instilled hope that there still might be a picturesque, one-size-fits-all grad experience in my future. My official high school graduation ceremony was a full cap and gown commencement, followed by a fancy banquet dinner and dance hosted at a local conference center. It was hyped up a ton through near daily school announcements of banquet ticket sales and frenzied discussion about grad dress cuts and colors. But what really had everyone talking was the after party. Rumors swirled for months about where it would be, who would organize it, how much alcohol everyone could bring, and if there would be any adult chaperones. Because unlike the official grad festivities, the after party wasn't run by school authorities. There was much more potential for wild times than at the tightly controlled ceremonies held by the school. Two girls from my grade eventually took the initiative to put together the after party, renting three buses for transportation to and from an undisclosed location to prevent drunken driving by attendees, choosing a venue, determining the rules, and distributing waiver forms to be signed by parents and guardians, and gradually, information began to leak about what would be going on at this secret party that everybody knew about. The planning of the after party didn't come without problems. There was a silent feud between those who desperately wanted the event to happen and those who violently opposed it. When too few students returned their waiver forms by the deadline, some of my classmates made passive-aggressive comments on Facebook about those who refused to attend in an effort to intimidate other students into going. There were other issues, too. The girls organizing the event were part of a particularly notable social group at school, and over time, I began to hear whispers about their favoritism. One of my friends texted me a copy of the list of students assigned to each bus and pointed out that there were clear divisions, with all the so-called popular kids on the first bus with the organizers, and everyone else divided up by their perceived social standing. While my friends and I knew that the organizers were bound to seat themselves with their friends, we weren't expecting such clear lines to be drawn about where the social pecking order for each attendee stood. There was something off-putting about sticking to these tired classifications when our graduation was meant to be a celebration of and for the entire grade. I was repelled by the idea that the organizers were first and foremost planning the after party themselves and their friends, and only extending invitations to the rest of the class under the guise of inclusion. The drama and exclusivity turned me and my friends off this weirdly hierarchical event. Over lunch one day, we decided that after attending our school's grad banquet, we would eschew the after party for our own celebration. Set on celebrating the night with our close friends, we planned to indulge in massive amounts of Doritos, play card games, and take the time to reminisce before our paths diverged. This alternative after party was a way to come together for one final official acknowledgement of our shared high school journey. Knowing that we'd each be surrounded by friends, the people who'd been integral to our years of collective growth made our plan feel particularly special. On the days leading up to grad, we heard more and more about the fun that would be going on at the after party. It was on everyone's lips. Are you going to the after party? Are you going to the after party? Constantly hearing about it made me a little concerned that I might be missing out on hanging out with my whole class during the most hyped party of the year. The FOMO was almost inescapable, and I worried that my classmates might judge me for electing to separate myself so completely from them when the night was supposed to be about unity. I still wanted to experience that euphoric, ever-elusive acceptance alumni talked about. I wanted finally to overcome the seemingly insurmountable social boundaries between the different groups. Plus, it was decidedly uncool to opt out of a wild night of drinking and bonfires. I thought over my choice, and over before grad night. Does this make me look like a weirdo? Should I just suck it up and go? Until the questions blended into an endless vortex of confusion. My friends reassured me that we were going to have a blast. I just needed to calm down. And a week before graduation, I found myself content with my choice. After dancing and pigging out at the grad banquet with my friends, we went to a mutual friend's house where we ate and played card games until a couple hours before dawn. Monopoly deal games were won and lost. We laughed over the dumb stuff we'd said and done as freshmen, grumbled about the banal homework assignments we'd had to hand in, and recalled the funny and exciting moments of student union events. We relived the fragments of experiences that had made even the worst moments of school bearable. Being confronted by friends, venting to people who cared, and adventures at the mall after a long week. Sitting under the dark night sky with my friends, I didn't regret going against the grain and ditching the post-grad event. We were too busy doing our own thing and cracking up over our own escapades. It turned out we'd made a pretty good decision, too. According to a friend of mine who went, the after party was a bit of a disaster. When I left my friend's house at 3:30 a.m., I felt almost frighteningly tranquil. I'd chosen to skip the official after party in favor of the company of my close friends and a night of comparatively calm games, and I wasn't worried about the judgment that I'd spent so much time thinking about before graduation. That night allowed me to let go of my fear of being perceived as less cool by the partying crowd. I didn't think I'd had a better time trying to force myself to follow someone else's version of a great graduation night. And sticking to my guns meant my party was tailored to me. Even if it deviated a little from the expectation of unbridled drinking and dancing until the departure of a final bus, it was my grad, not anybody else's, and I spent it with people who made the night better than any other party could have been. The simple pleasure of being surrounded by friends I loved and the memory of laughing until I cried was much more than enough. The next article for today's program is from Teen Vogue's OG History series, and it's titled, Sacagawea Changed the Course of History and Deserves Respect. This article is by Ruth Hopkins and was published back in January 11th of 2019. President Donald Trump's attacks against Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, President Donald Trump's attacks against Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democratic Senator of Massachusetts, have been relentless since his campaign began. Trump has called her Pocahontas, attempting to use the name as a racial slur to fire up his base. But his usage is actually an insult to this country's indigenous people, some of whom have even been present when the president has taken a jab at Warren by using the name. Pocahontas' name is not an insult, but he is using it as one. Pointed requests from a plethora of Native voices that he stop respecting Pocahontas, myself included, stop disrespecting Pocahontas, myself included, have done nothing to stop his disrespectful references to a young Native girl who was kidnapped, held hostage, and raped by European invaders. The disrespect continued in January when a member of his party, Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida, referred to Warren as Sacagawea. Like Pocahontas, Sacagawea was a real person, one whose life is directly tied to America's colonial history. Yet another attempt from the right to turn an indigenous person's name into an insult didn't go unnoticed. Newly elected Native Representative Deb Haaland, Democrat from New Mexico, addressed Gaetz on Twitter, reminding him of Sacagawea's rightful place in American history and calling his remarks offensive and hurtful. Haaland even offered on Twitter to meet with Gaetz to discuss the matter. Seemingly in return, he appeared to dismiss Haaland and took jabs at yet another woman of color, Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Missouri. While many people are more familiar with Pocahontas, Sacagawea seems to be less often discussed in pop culture, but her life greatly influenced the country we live in today. So just who was she? The woman known as Sacagawea, whose name has been varied spellings, was a member of the Lemmi Band of Shoshone. When she was about 12, she was captured by Hidatsa buffalo hunters and brought to their lands near present-day Bismarck, North Dakota. Sacagawea was integrated into the Hidatsa people, now part of the three affiliated tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, and adopted their culture and language. Sacagawea, in Hidatsi, or bird woman in English, has become an important figure in both American Indian history and identity, and as an icon of the woman's suffrage movement. Alicia Deegan, who is Hidatsa and Sanish, a citizen of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikari Nation in North Dakota, and the Interpretation and Cultural Resource Program Manager at Knife River Indian Villages, National Historic Site, she tells Teen Vogue. Deegan notes that Sacagawea's name is often misspelled and misused, saying these variations exist because misidentification is not something new to the first people of this continent. She was one of three wives of Toussaint Charbonneau and went along with her husband on the Lewis and Clark expedition because of her ties to the Shoshone Nation. There are many questions about Sacagawea and her life, but what we do know demonstrates that she was an amazing and strong woman, Deegan says. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark were explorers charged with surveying the newly acquired Louisiana Purchase, a vast swath of land between the Mississippi River and the Rocky Mountains, and from the Canadian border to the Gulf of Mexico, by President Thomas Jefferson in 1803. He also hoped that they would discover a Northwest Passage that would connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through continuous waterways. This important expedition would influence the shape of the United States on the map and as an economic power. About a year later, Lewis and Clark reached the Hidatsa Mandan settlement, where Sacagawea was living with her husband. Initially, Lewis and Clark were primarily interested in Sacagawea's skills as a translator for the continuation of their expedition. since Sacagawea was fluent in both the Hidatsa and Shoshone languages. With Charbonneau, a French-Canadian fur trader who spoke French and Hidatsa, and another member of the expedition who knew French, Sacagawea would enable Lewis and Clark to converse with the Shoshone people from whom they needed to purchase horses. Sacagawea was also acquainted with the wild terrain and potential dangers they would face along the rest of their journey. When Sacagawea joined the expedition, she was only about 16 years old and had a two-month-old son. She would travel with them for 2 years, from October 1804 to August 1806, from North Dakota to the Pacific Ocean and back. She was the only woman in the group of 33. She accomplished her duties as a translator, but she did so much more than that. Sacagawea would prove invaluable to the expedition. When a boat capsized, it was she who remained calm and maintained the wherewithal to rescue key papers, books, navigational instruments, medicines, and other necessities. She taught expedition members about medicinal native plants and was a natural survivalist who knew how to identify edible roots and berries. Clark would later call her his pilot because she was such a good navigator and knew the land so well. Sacagawea was also a peacemaker. When Lewis and Clark encountered indigenous people who had never seen a white man before, this young Shoshone woman with a little baby in her arms helped to ease native tension, uncertainty, and suspicion. Even though Lewis and Clark arguably never would have completed their government-funded mission without her, Sacagawea was never compensated for her services. Her husband received 320 acres of land and $500.33. Sacagawea returned to what would later be known as Dakota Territory and died after giving birth to a daughter. She was just 25 years old. Clark took guardianship of her two children, though it is not known whether her daughter, Lisette, lived past infancy. Her name can be found on maps today, like Lake Sacagawea in Washington State and Lake Sacagawea in North Dakota are named after her. Monuments and statues of her supposed likeness exist, including one in Washington, D.C. She was an inspiration for the women's movement for equal rights, as many have considered her a role model and the face of the National Women's Suffrage Association in the early 20th century. Sacagawea's likeness is even on a dollar commemorative coin, first issued in the year 2000. Sacagawea's influence cannot be understated. What she did in her short life and in the face of so much risk was nothing short of incredible. Her work helped establish the modern makeup of this country. Dishonoring her memory is not only wildly inappropriate, but also unconscionable. Attempting to use her name in a racially derogatory manner exacerbates a mounting litany of genocidal devices used to erase, oppress, and exterminate American Indians. It is unbecoming of anyone, especially those holding public office. And everyone, including non-natives, should demand an apology for the misuse of her name. There is an epidemic of missing and murdered Native women on the North American continent, and their continued dehumanization is vile. The fact that the remains of Olivia Lone Bear, a Native woman who went missing for 9 months, were found in Lake Sacagawea, exemplifies this connection between past and present. We must defend all Native women, regardless of their time or place in history. We have suffered and endured, but we still stand strong, Deegan says. Everyone can do their part by being conscious of the terms they use and how these words can affect others. The first step to creating change is being aware that using these terms and names in a derogatory manner is not okay. All right, our next article is titled, this is from Teen Vogue, titled Joshua Bassett Talks HSM Series Season 2 and Toxic Masculinity. This article is by Gianluca Russo, and it was published May 14th, 2021. Joshua Bassett is more than just another sweet-faced Troy Bolton. Through music, through acting, through reading, or all of the above, I'm trying to be the best possible version of myself, he tells Teen Vogue. I'm constantly evolving in that way, and I'll probably be a completely different person by this time next year, hopefully for the better. But for now, Joshua is starring as Ricky Bowen on Disney Plus High School Musical, the musical The Series, which drops its second season on May 14th. A former theater kid turned up-and-coming musician, Joshua is a rising face among Gen Z artists who prioritize sincerity. Raised in San Diego, the 20-year-old is a multi-skilled performer who is seeking honesty at every turn he takes, even when that means opening wounds for wider audiences. That's part of why he relates so deeply to his character Ricky. His initial avoidance of life problems, his growing passion for music, and his determination to give everything his all resonate with Joshua. This season especially, he's really trying to be the best that he can be, despite kind of continuously falling on his face, Joshua says. The stakes are higher this time around. If season one was about finding your new tribe, season two is about keeping it and really prioritizing who and what matters in your life, he explains. Between those messages of love and acceptance are standout performances from Joshua and his fellow castmates, including Olivia Rodrigo and Sophia Wiley. Getting the gang back together for season two was an emotional experience as the COVID-19 pandemic halted and complicated production. But it was in those moments that Joshua realized how impactful the show is, especially coming off a year filled with self-reflection and inner discovery. It's important to be able to see a piece of you on screen, and that can be really therapeutic, he says. I hope people find a lot of peace and joy in this season. But there's far more to Joshua than just his character on screen. For starters, his music, with a debut self-titled EP released earlier this year. Much of Joshua's musical success is thanks to his frank vulnerability, a testament to the young star's emotional maturity. He explains that from an early age, he's always been super emotional, despite those who told him that men should stop crying and toughen up or suck it up. That sort of forced me to kind of push that more sensitive side down, he explains. And I think as I've gotten older, I sort of realized how unhealthy that is and how important it is to be in tune with your emotions and allow yourself to be vulnerable and to be seen. In the days following our interview, Joshua shared more on this topic to his millions of followers, opening up about his sexuality and the long-reaching effects of toxic masculinity. It's 2021. We are the generation of love and growth. It's time we start acting like it, he wrote on Instagram. Whether you love me, hate me, or darn me to hell, I love you all the same. He finished the post. Love who you love shamelessly. It's okay to still be figuring out who you are. Life's too short to let ignorance and hatred win. I choose love. As he navigates young stardom, harnessing that vulnerability is an everyday task, as he frets about putting up a wall and shutting down under the pressures of Hollywood, especially as the rising careers of the High School Musical cast have led to heightened scrutiny and internet gossip. I really am trying my best, and maybe people don't get to see that emotional side to me all the time, but I try to be as authentic and real as possible, he says. That desire to reach ultimate authenticity is what's driven Joshua to fall in love with the music of Harry Styles, gravitating towards his honest and carefree spirit. The two share a lot of similarities in their sound, as well as their personal style. He's not afraid to be very vulnerable and artistic and his complete self, and that's super inspiring to me. Lyrics like, "Well, I'm sure that you're hurting inside, but why would you take your pain... Why would you make your pain mine? You're making me pay for your crimes. From his single Only a Matter of Time, stand out as particularly poignant. Joshua's ability to paint with past pain strike. Sorry, Joshua's ability to paint with past pain strikes a chord with many listeners, both from within and outside the High School Musical fandom. You have to be able to sit with those uncomfortable emotions, he says, and ultimately, if you're honest with yourself, you can't go wrong. The beauty of being an artist is when you express yourself authentically and honestly. It resonates with so many people because so much of our human experience is universal. With this music, Joshua hopes that listeners will take those universal messages and apply them to their own personal lives, rather than create rumored narratives and worry about how the lyrics apply directly to him. Coming up, more music, of course. Joshua is currently playing around with different genres in the studio. Not afraid to throw paint to the wall with his next project, even if it means an album of 12 very different yet touching tunes. There's no reason why I should put myself in a box, he says. And then there are his quirks and charms, like taking cold showers every single morning, or reading books like The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. A self-described realistic dreamer, Joshua is all about making those happily ever afters come true. A lot of people think that there's a separation between dreams and reality, when I believe the truth is a lot closer than you think, he says. The only limitations are those you put on yourself. His top goal in life, however, is growth. My number one priority is growth. I think I strive for greatness and I strive for well-being. My hope is that we can all sort of help each other out in growing and being the best we can be and being at peace in finding joy and love. And there is a photo here with that accompanies this article of Mr. Joshua Bassett that is courtesy of Disney Plus and is likely a photo of him posing as his character from the show High School Musical, the musical, the series. But a very inspiring and hopefully motivating and uplifting message from Mr. Joshua Bassett. I realize that a lot of the articles that I've read have been about young women stars, and so I figured it would be good to point one out of a young male star. So, that's all that we have for today. We have run out of time, and this is the end of today's Teen Magazine episode. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you have enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This episode is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.